You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Anne Lyle. Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Doc Coleman, filling in for Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is an opportunity for us to sit down with our amazing guest hosts and discover more about how they do what they do.
Yes, indeed. And Doc, thank you so much for filling in for Brian on this edition of 20 Minutes With. I really appreciate it.
Very happy to do so.
Yes, Brian couldn't be here, but we've got Doc to man the helm. And Doc, you have come in at a very auspicious time because our guest host for this episode of 20 Minutes With is someone I consider sort of an every woman of the writers out there who have sat down and felt the burn, the desire, the need to write. I must write. And our guest host's story is a wonderful tribute to that passion, that desire. May I regale you with it, sir?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Oh, delightful. First and foremost, the thing that most endears me to our guest host is the fact that she is a former tabletop RPG and live-action gamer, which... Yeah.
Only the best people.
Indeed.
Only the best people.
The highest quality people start off that way. Now, 9 years ago, she hadn't finished a single novel. And at that time, she vowed that in 10 years' time, by God, she would have finished at least one novel. Mm-hmm. Now, like many writers, she participated in NaNoWriMo, which is a wonderful exercise. Many of our previous guest writers and authors have done so. And then participated in a workshop at the Winchester Writers Conference, led by the noted British fantasy author Juliet McKenna, who suggested that our guest hosts, among other things, start attending conventions. Now, you have to understand, if anybody, any of our guests out there, fans out there, rather, have never attended a conference, you may have some preconceptions, and our guest host is no exception. But she did dive into the con experience, and after discovering that it was more than just a nerd sausage fest, she signed up for Holly Lyle's online course, How to Revise Your Novel, which allowed her to hone her skills at editing her manuscript. And by FantasyCon 2010, she had her first novel completed and had started sending out queries.
Excellent.
Now, yes, exactly. Awesomeness. Now, at that convention, she was introduced to Mark Gascoigne of Angry Robot Books. And that's when things started happening. Chapters got sent, offers were made, agents acquired, and lo, the firmament of fantasy fiction has a new jewel shining within it. Alchemist of Souls, the first book of the Night Mask trilogy, and that's Mask with a Q-U-E in reference to the medieval stage production aesthetic, has arrived and shines brightly on bookstore shelves and ebook shops everywhere. So, Doc and friends, please help me in welcoming to the Skype line our guest host for this episode, Anne Lyle. Anne, thank you so much for taking time out of what I'm sure is a very busy schedule and joining us here on the Roundtable Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You're very welcome. And let's not waste any time about this. I'm going to set the timer here, and I would like to start taking advantage of our 20 minutes with by asking you this. In Alchemist of Souls, which, dear friends, if you have not picked up this jewel, do so. It is rich, lush, and lovely, with a wonderful storyline and a wonderful invigoration of Shakespeare's England. And you infused into that story the concept of the Skraelings, a mystic other race. And that is a very common trope in fantasy fiction, the introduction of alien races or the other in the context of the storyline. And I wanted you to speak, if you could, about why you elected to do so, what it added to your story to have the Skraelings in there, and the process that you went to decide their qualities and how they would engage with the primary story arc that you're telling in Alchemist of Souls.
Well, I've always been a science fiction fan, actually. And one of the science fiction tropes that really interests me is contact with aliens. But also I'm interested in medieval and early modern history. And I kind of saw a parallel there of the Age of Discovery. And I thought, you know, what if the discoverers found aliens, in effect, on our world? I mean, not space aliens.
Sure. But something other than human.
Yes, exactly. Something that was, they thought was like something from their folklore or mythology, but was actually a real species.
Okay.
So we've got some other kind of terrestrial intelligence that may or may not be the foundation for all this mythology and folklore.
Yes, pretty much.
Now, how did you take that concept, that essence of the discovery of a non-human race, and incorporate that, you know, without giving away spoilers, because we don't want to give anything away, but what was it about the Skraelings and that concept that caught your attention, and how did you weave it into the storyline? What do they serve in the context of the story arc that you're offering?
Ooh, that is difficult to say without spoilers.
Oh. Okay, step back 30,000 feet.
I've already blogged on John Scalzi's big idea about how I was inspired by Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Ah, yes.
About the contact between Europe and the Native Americans. And one of my ideas was, what if the Europeans went to the Americas and found it wasn't a pushover, and that there were sophisticated people there who were capable of resisting in a way that the Europeans couldn't quite get their heads around, the same way that the Native Americans couldn't quite understand European tactics and motives.
Okay.
So sort of as if the Native Americans had their own kind of technology that was at least a match for what the Europeans had.
Well, yeah. At that point, it was maybe technology, maybe magic. You know, it could have gone either way.
Okay.
And can you walk, for our listeners who are tuning in, can you walk them through the process of how you developed and evolved the Skraeling culture? Because a lot of writers are in the process of or planning to evolve their own alien or other races in the context of their stories. And what did, from the inception of the idea, we need to have the Europeans discover these things, how did you evolve the Skraelings in terms of their culture and how they would engage with the book?
Well, I should probably point out, I have a degree in zoology.
That always helps.
With a particular interest in animal behavior. So I basically cherry-picked a few interesting ideas that I'd come across over the years, bits of animal and bird behavior, and kind of smooshed them together and built up the culture from there, because, you know, our culture in some senses comes out of our biology and,
sure,
you know, our mating behavior and how we relate to other individuals in our group and so on. And so I did that with the Skraelings.
That's outstanding, because I've heard of writers going out and taking, you know, random snapshots off of like Flickr or Photo Bucket or somewhere, and using those as story prompts for whole ideas. And what you've done is you've gone to biology, you've gone to zoology and done the same thing, only with species traits and capabilities. That's intriguing.
It's like the ideas are all around you. You just got to take things that you're already familiar with and look at them in a new way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I find nonfiction is a huge inspiration. Just go read any nonfiction that you're interested in, whether it's space science or robotics or biology or anthropology or history, or you'll come across cool ideas and think, I could put that in a story.
And then, being a speculative fiction author, you can take those ideas and cobble them together any way you want.
Absolutely.
Now, Anne, you've done something intriguing on your website that I don't think I've ever heard of any other author doing. You have offered up deleted scenes from your first...
Because I've never done this before.
That's brilliant. Now,
yeah, and it's absolute genius. And it's like, it's like, why the hell aren't the rest of us doing that?
It did help that my book had gone through quite a few revisions, and I'd written chapters and thrown them away, and written other chapters and thrown them away. So I did have quite a lot of material from early on in the book that didn't have any spoilers in it that I could put out there and people could enjoy without, you know, ruining the book for them.
That's excellent. Now, but you're not alone in that. I mean, I'm sure every author, certainly Nathan Lowell, has tossed aside whole novellas in his development of his stories, and every author goes through that. What led you to take that extra step and make that available to your fans?
I'm a big movie fan, and I love DVDs with extras.
Special features of the book.
It is. One of my favorite DVDs, that in fact is A Knight's Tale, not particularly because of the movie, although I love the movie. It's a lot of fun, and you know, it's guys jousting. Yeah, what's not to like?
It's awesome. And Heath Ledger, which is cool.
Absolutely. But if you go and look at the special features, not only do they have deleted scenes, but they have a commentary from either the writer or the director or someone talking about why they deleted those scenes, why they thought they were going to put them in the movie, why they decided in the end that, you know, maybe slow down the pacing, or you know, it just didn't work. And as a writer, I found that absolutely fascinating. So when I found myself with all these cool things that I thought, yeah, this is the biggest deleted scene is actually my hero Mal gets talked into participating in a river joust, which was a late medieval Elizabethan sport. Basically two boats would row towards each other very fast, and there'd be a guy in the prow with a big, you know, like a lance padded on the end, and row towards one another and try and knock each other in the water.
My brain was just going river dance with jousting for a month.
But you know, I couldn't think of how I was going to put that later in the book, because it doesn't really fit the storyline, and I thought, you know, it's a shame to just leave that on my hard drive. I got onto my editor Mark and said, you know, how about posting some deleted scenes on my website? And he said, go for it. Awesome. So I did. Yeah, I polished them up, made a few name changes so there weren't any glaring differences from the finished book. And then posted them.
I think that's just brilliant, because most people, when they delete those scenes, they don't even save them somewhere else. They just throw those electrons away. But you actually had the presence of mind to say, this scene. I'm going to put it aside over here. And then it was there to have something done with it. That's absolutely fantastic.
I'm a hoarder of files. I use Scrivener, which has its own built-in trash. So you delete a scene and it just goes in the trash bin within your project. So you open it up 3 years later and, you know, the old scenes are all still there for you to go and plunder.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Anne Lyle after this brief promotional break.
When the aliens known as the Hezrin invaded our solar system, we were defenseless against their power and technology. But at our darkest hour, from the mind of a mad genius, came our salvation, the Titans. Using nanotechnology that turned ordinary soldiers into armored warriors with the strength to tear starships in half, the Titans not only repelled the alien invaders, but vowed to chase them across the galaxy until the Hezrin were destroyed. That was 100 years ago. Neither the Titans nor the Hezrin have been heard from since. Now, finally, the Titans have returned. But instead of coming home as conquering heroes, they've been infected by a virus that's driven them insane and compelled them to destroy everything they'd fought so long and hard to protect. Standing between them and humanity's destruction is a scholar, her son, and the only Titan able to resist the infection. Will they find a way to save humanity from its own greatest weapon? Matthew Wayne Selznick, author of The Sovereign Era Story World, says Haywire is sure to satisfy cravings for Saturday matinee high-adventure space fantasy. And Alan Baxter, author of Realm Shift and Mage Sign, has called Haywire a thrilling chase through a superbly realized future solar system. Enhanced warriors, space pirates, galactic threats, and more make this a powerful debut from a strong new voice in speculative fiction. Haywire is a science fiction adventure novel written by Justin R. McCumber and published by Griffinwood Press. It's available online in print and ebook formats from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Smashwords, and the Apple iBook Store. You can learn more about the author at his website, justinmccumber.com.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Anne Lyle. Now, this is your first novel, Anne, but you have been writing clearly for at least 10 years, if not longer. Do you find that keeping those old files, do you refer back to them as a writer? Do you find rich material to draw from in preserving those old efforts?
Very much so. I mean, before I typed everything up, I handwrote things. So I have the literal trunk of a box of stuff under my bed of notebooks and things.
Oh, wait, sleep over it? It's like putting it under your pillow and letting it seep up into your dreams. That's awesome.
So when I submitted my first version of this book to Marco, and he said, "We love it, but it needs more magic," because I'm a big fan of Ellen Kushner and George R. R. Martin and those people who, there's really not very much magic in their books.
Sure.
But he wanted more magic, so I went away to my son of the bed and went, there's this stuff here which kind of dovetails nicely into the bit of magic that was already in the book. I can bring that in and soup it up a bit.
That's awesome. So instead of Pandora's box, it's Anne Lyle's box.
Yes,
and you open it up and there's wonders.
It's where she keeps the magic under the bed.
Writers, take note. That's awesome. And do you have a theater background?
I do, actually. Okay. Sort of. Well, amateur theater. My parents met through an amateur dramatic society, doing musicals, lots of classic American musicals, Oklahoma and Annie Get Your Gun and all that kind of thing. And also pantomime, which is a British tradition of plays, comic plays based on fairy tales, Mother Goose stories,
okay.
Robin Hood, Jack and the Beanstalk, Cinderella,
okay.
In which the Cinderella's ugly sisters or Jack's mother is played by a man in drag, who is my dad.
Okay.
I grew up going to rehearsals, and when I was about 8, 9 or so, I was in one of these. I danced in the, it was Babes in the Wood, which is a Robin Hood story.
Oh, lovely.
I danced in that. And that was about it. Okay. I did a little bit at school, directing a school play, but I haven't really done any theatre stuff since then.
Doc and I were talking before we brought everybody on the Skype line about how many actors there are in the writing circles, especially on the Roundtable podcast. Many of our writers and authors have...
And my agent used to be an actor.
See, and there it is. It's everywhere. In fact, I wrote a blog post about how actors make better characters. We write better characters. And I wondered if you would speak just a little bit about what do you see... Do you feel that your theater background has infused... or informed your writing at all?
Probably not directly, because it was a long time ago. Although the whole cross-dressing stuff seems to have crept into my book.
Well, that'll mess anybody up, absolutely.
Yeah, So there's also, I mean, it's not just the man in drag. There's also the principal boy is actually a girl dressed as a boy.
Of course.
Yes.
Classic Shakespearean trope there.
Yes, exactly. But apart from that, it was just kind of like not having to do so much research for the theatre portions of my book, I guess.
Well, and you've done a lot of academic research, of course, into the time and the name of the trilogy, Night Mask, and the fact that the theatre figures so prominently in the story arc. I'm curious, what was it about the theater that you glommed onto and then wove into the theme and the arc of the story so intimately?
Well, I'd always loved Shakespeare. We did it at school. It was the only bit of English lit I really enjoyed. We got to go to plays, which was always fun. I hadn't really thought about putting it in a book until I read a non-fiction book called The Reckoning, which is about the murder of Christopher Marlowe.
Okay.
Which, historically speaking, back in 1593, only happened difference. A couple of days ago, the end of May, 1593.
Ah.
And Marlowe was both a playwright and, we think, a spy.
Wonderful story material there.
Yes. And the book was all about speculation about his connections with Walsingham and the nascent Elizabethan Secret Service.
Oh.
And I thought, spies and acting. Yeah, put those together. That's just such a cool combination for a story.
I find it interesting, especially coming from the podcast realm, the way that we do, is that so many of the writers and podcasters have a theater background, a role-playing background, or both, so that we're all so immersed in the characters. And the
putting on of masks.
With the podcasting, the presentation of the characters so that they're recognizable.
Yeah, very much so. And I wanted to ask, I'm sure that in spite of your long years of practice and working at your craft, it's a never-ending process. And I was wondering, what are you working on now specifically in refining or improving your skills as a writer? And what are you doing to focus on those particular aspects?
Well, I'm actually in the middle of revising book two of the trilogy.
Okay. Merchant of Dreams.
Yes. My basic process is to very, very roughly outline a book and then just kind of brain dump it. I find the ideas don't tend to flow until I'm, you know, right in there with the characters. And obviously sometimes it goes a bit off track. I write scenes that, you know, seem like a good idea at the time. And so I'm trying to refine my my overall process of how I get a book down on paper and then revise it. Because the first one took a long time because it really was a huge learning curve. I'd never actually finished a novel before this one. I started loads.
Sure.
And just kind of run out of steam.
Haven't we all?
So in NaNoWriMo terms, you're a pantser. You write by the seat of your pants.
Well, except that I did actually brainstorm like 80-odd scenes for the first book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew I was inclined to just like think the idea was no good and run out of steam. So I did kind of outline it and, you know, at least write
a loose outline.
A sentence. Yeah, it was like just a line per scene. You know, they go to the tavern and talk to so-and-so. Getting the plot focused and heading in the right direction and moving the characters on is and in because I have, you know, three to four viewpoint characters.
Mm-hmm.
And juggling all of those and making it all make sense is quite a thing. But I found that doing a single character story was when I tended to run out of steam. So.
Ah, okay. So reinfuse the mojo by adding new POVs to give you more stuff to glom onto and get excited about.
Yes.
Okay. What are you taking any specific steps in that process of refining? How is your writing process changing as you go through these various stages of development?
Well, I'm basically applying the methods I learned through Holly Lyle's course.
Ah, okay.
Which is, you know, I write the story and then I put it all down on physical index cards. And then I go through those and analyze them and also read my manuscript and work out where it's not working, and then I scribble on them and shuffle them and try and get it to behave itself.
Rather like herding cats, I'm given to understand. Excellent. Our time is almost up, Anne, but I had to ask one last question. With all of the genres of the world out there laid before you, you've got horror, you've got procedural police dramas, you've got romance. What drove you? What is it about the story that you want to tell that puts you in so squarely into the fantasy and speculative fiction genre?
It's just what I always read from, you know, when I was old enough to go to the library and pick books out. Okay. I started out reading science fiction. I got into Tolkien and stuff when I was an older teenager. Okay. And I just like the whole going to other worlds thing.
And one other last bit, and this may be the toughest one. What do you think the value of spec fic and fantasy is in the context of literature and culture?
It just gives you a broader canvas to play on. You know, if you're, I mean, it's something I found quite confining in some ways in writing a historical fantasy that's actually set in a historical period, is if you want to be true to that world, you're stuck with the attitudes of the time. Right. You know, these are people who are quite xenophobic and sexist, and some of them quite homophobic, but not all. And you don't have any choice in that, whereas speculative fiction allows you to play around with all the parameters, like, you know, like in a scientific experiment, say, you know, what if the world was like this, except...
Right.
Mm-hmm. We can, you know, the world doesn't have to be like this, it can be different.
Absolutely. And with that, dear friends, the time has run out. And as usual, Anne, we could continue this for a very long time. But let me just say thank you so much for taking the time and sharing so generously of your perspectives. That means a lot to us.
You're welcome. I had fun.
Yeah, so did we. Nice. Doc, any last comments before we wrap this bad boy up?
The only one I've came up with is that you said in your beginning introduction that she started writing about less than 10 years ago, and that means that in this business, she's an overnight success. Well done, Anne. Well done.
That's not entirely true. I've been writing since my teens. Ah. I've been writing seriously to try and get published for about 10 years.
Okay. That Doc's point is well taken, though. That's an overnight success.
That's an overnight success in this business.
Well, awesome. Well, friends, thank you, as always, for tuning in. We do appreciate it. You close the circuit for us, and that's always appreciated. If you're having fun, go ahead and take a turn out to iTunes, if you would. Drop a line. A few words is always like coins in the cup for us, and we definitely appreciate it. If you have other comments or observations, you can come out to the websites, www.roundtablepodcast.com. Ding! And feel free to drop a comment on the post. Drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. We would love to hear from you. And in the interim, just continue to be awesome. Doc, any closing advice for our listeners as we segue off to Coolsville?
Well, the only advice I've got is the one that we've heard so often. Go right.
Go right. Brian is cheering somewhere in the mountains of Colorado. Go right. Yes, absolutely. Go right. Friends, you find what you're looking for. So look for awesomeness. Look for wow. Put it on paper and make it real. Thanks so much. Come back in a couple of days, and we'll be back to workshop an episode with Veronica Giguere. It's going to be awesome. Don't miss it. Until then, be cool. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms.
Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.